welcome to another fine edition of my so-called 8-bit life. I am your host, Robert Villegas. If I sound a little gravitas today, a little Tom Waits-like, it's because I'm kind of under the weather, people, and I just want to bear with that. I mean, God, I really should do that intro, like, welcome to my so-called 8-bit life. I'm your host. You know, just literally just go off the rails and talk about some, you know, thing about how I'm big in Japan and just, you know, make some kind of weird folk. Never mind. Let me introduce my guest before I get into our topic today. We are doing a roundtable discussion, and before I do that, I need to introduce my guests. First and foremost, my good friend, my Diablo compadre, if you will, Stephen Apostolos.
Hello.
How's it going, good sir?
Oh, it is doing. I'm doing quite well, actually. And like you, I'm under the weather, except it's pretty literal. It's raining like hell, and I'm hoping that I don't lose the power during this podcast.
Well, you may want to go buy a generator while the time being, because if you lose power, I swear to God, this is going to be a horrible podcast. We'll play it by ear, whatever happens. Now comes the first part, the first and foremost thing I've ever done on a podcast. I want to introduce my good friend, my good chat realm buddy, a person I've chatted on many hangouts, played many games with. And you're going to wonder why I'm saying this, and I'll explain in a second. Mr. Dryosynth.
Hello.
Now, the reason why, now you're probably wondering, everyone in the audience who's listened to this podcast many times is going, hey, wait a minute, that doesn't sound like a real name. And you'd be wrong. That is actually his birth name. So don't insult him. He's got some hippie parents that decided to give him a weird, strange name, like Rainbow or, you know, Steam. I don't know why.
I would have preferred Steam.
I would have preferred Steam or Low Car or some other bullshit name than Dryos. No, the reason why Dryos is a very, very I guess, private individual in terms of names, and though
it's paranoid.
It's paranoid. It's okay. I've tried to prod and pry his name and everything else and that. And normally, you know me, I'm big on names just because of knowing a person, things like that. In this case, however, Dryo has pretty much proven he's one of the more knowledgeable persons in this sort of roundtable discussion. And when the needle is, you know, when the needle is up and there's a side of real names versus content, it swings automatically the content. That is the mission of this podcast. And so, and plus, we're gonna get really nerdy on this. And Dryo in real life has a real reputation to kind of keep up with. I mean, it turns out, like, in real life, he's actually a really popular guy. He's actually like this tar football player or something like that, right? And then this, you know, something like that, where you're like, you actually give a damn what people think about you. I'm kidding, of course. Dryo is actually a big, much like everybody on this podcast, is kind of a big nerd. And we're about to get real nerdy real quickly, because today our discussion is on graphic adventure games, which the only reason I picked graphic adventure games, and this is literally not bullshitting, I picked it so I could talk about Seeing Worlds and actually still apply. Because for some reason, if you use like 2D graphic, I use graphic adventures so I could encompass everything, like Seeing Worlds and LucasArts and in Dryo's sense, because I never played any of them, the Sierra games. And I had to go like, how do I make sure I can include point and click adventure games at the same time include games like Tales of Monkey Island that you have to use text commands and sort of this hybrid world? And that's the only way I could do it, is to use graphic adventure. Before we do begin, let me actually define what the hell a graphic adventure is according to Wikipedia. It is a form of venture game. They are distinct from text adventures because, whereas a player actively observing using, you know, commands such as look in text-based adventure, graphic adventure revolutionized the gameplay by making use of natural human perception. Basically, everything on the screen, you actually saw your character on the screen. You saw, you know, your little avatar walking through the world and doing the adventure, whatever that happens to be. So here's a question I got asked before we even get into the discussion, and we'll start with Dryo, just because I'm seeing his blankless avatar in front of me right now. What was your first graphic adventure game?
I think it might have been Loom.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I never played Loom, and I always wanted to, you know, ever since the whole Monkey Island giant advertisement of Loom in there. It, So Loom was your first, and Loom was definitely one of the bigger LucasArts ones. It was one of the first ones that came out. I mean, not the first ones, but, you know, in the initial kind of – the early days, if you will.
I don't know if I could actually say I played it. It was just – I was playing over the shoulder of my father.
Okay. Well, that's fine. That's okay. That's still a, still a valid play, I mean, in terms of just everything else. What was it that, like, caught your eye? I mean, obviously, you know, you're seeing your father play. You're like, ah, whatever. But, I mean, or, you know, you could have been that. Like, was there something that caught your eye? Because, I mean, for me, if I do that, for example, my first, I think, official point-and-click adventure game that I played, or graphic adventure game, I should say, was Full Throttle. That was my first. But I think even earlier, I had actually was at a Christmas party. And, like, the older kid that was the older kid who had a computer had gotten Myst as a Christmas gift. And he keeps clicking around and going to the puzzles, the initial, like, here's where you find the key to whatever and everything else. And he got bored because he wasn't really a dedicated kind of gamer in that regard. He just was kind of this, not really a jock per se, but just, your typical kind of teen kid that was like, let me go watch the football game and everything else. And I'm like, you know, whereas I, the small kid of wonder, was like, no, stop. I know how to solve this puzzle. I know that's the number to the safe and everything else. And you look at this world and you know, me looking at this beautiful, you know, 3D kind of rendered world in on the island of Myst and being way more engaged and way more attracted to that versus the other guy. Is there more thing when you're watching your father play at all? Or
I think it was because when I was watching him play, it wasn't, I could understand it, but it was highbrow. I mean, it wasn't playing down to me, and I could understand it. So it was educational, but it wasn't. It's not. It wasn't poking fun at kids. I think. I mean, a kid could get it, but it wasn't going down to their level.
It wasn't pandering to you, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Steven. What about you? What was your first?
First game. Well, you plucked one right from under me, and that was Myst. But it wasn't just Myst, it was Myst and Seventh Guest that
I
remember.
So you had the world of Rand Miller in front of you, this beautiful landscape where you're like, oh, everything's peaceful and you know, everything is interactive with this, whereas Seventh Guest is like, you better run, motherfucker, or else you're gonna die.
Exactly. It was such a grinding of the gears too, to go from, because I had both of them, and you know, I'd be like, oh, I'm gonna play a little bit of Myst, so I play that, and I'd be like, okay, I'll save there. And then I go to, and it's a similar gameplay style, but the games themselves are two separate, completely different things. So just like you said, you know, it's you know, Myst is very beautiful and serene, and you can take your time, whereas in Seventh Guest, if you don't move it, you know, your ass is grass pretty much.
Exactly.
And was there a timer in Seventh Guest?
Oh, you know what? I can't remember.
There was something along the lines of a timer where, because I remember that if you made the wrong turn, like the beauty thing about Myst, and now we're kind of getting into talking about seeing worlds just in general in games like this. For the most part, a characteristic for those of you there who've never played a graphic adventure game in their entire life, one of the characteristics of a graphic adventure game is that the player usually doesn't die. You usually do not. usually, because there are those very, very few and far between. And at that point, I call those Easter eggs, to be freaking honest.
You said at the beginning you've never played a Sierra game.
Well, yeah. Well, usually in a you know, in terms of what I've, you know, in my definition, and maybe that usually you don't die. Usually, death can happen, and there's certain things that if you make the wrong decision, your character will get killed. Usually, if you happen to piss off the bad guy or do something else, and that's what happens. But usually, you're not, for example, having to time your jump before you live, or watch where watch exactly where you leap.
Timing things are usually not included in
right
adventure games.
Within Seventh Guest, though, one of the biggest things it was since it was this horror kind of game, if you made the wrong turn or solved the puzzle incorrectly, you died or your game was over. And it wasn't like, you know, you weren't given like a second chance to solve that puzzle. At least that's what I remember the game was. It was some weird mechanic because it was like you're in a, you know, a haunted mansion or something like that. And
right, right. And you know, and it's been so many moons since the last time I played it. I think I managed – the last time I played it was probably like mid-2004-ish and – trying to get it to run was next to impossible just because my machine was too new for the game.
Well, because, like, didn't it get ported to the iPhone or was that – or was it the other one?
It got recently ported, but
– I was kind of tempted to buy it to find out.
It's worth buying.
The only puzzle that I remember from the game is the Queen's Challenge, the chessboard.
Oh, God.
You seem to be annoyed by this puzzle.
Well, I'm not so much annoyed. It's just the thing about those games, I mean, once you figure out how the puzzles work, I mean, and this is not just for Seventh Guest or its sequel, 11th Hour, which I think 11th Hour is the one that has the timer. I'm not sure.
Maybe 11th Hour. I forget. I mean,
I can't remember.
They blur in my head sometimes.
Yeah, but and it's kind of universal with these kinds of games is that, you know, once you figure out the puzzle, you know, it's like, oh, that was pretty straightforward and simple. But like in terms of Myst, first time I played through it, it took me months to even get through one of the ages just because the puzzles were so – they were so different to anything else that I was accustomed to, you know, and this is coming from, you know, somebody who, you know, grew up with Atari, NES, you know, stuff like that. So I was kind of used to, you know, platformers, RPGs, things like that. So when a game like this came along with these intricate puzzles, I was just like, fuck, how the hell am I? And this is before, you know, high speed internet was readily available to everybody, so you were kind of on your own trying to figure this thing out. Well, go ahead.
No, I was gonna actually kind of pull it in and explain, especially people who've never played Myst, because there's, I mean, as much as you and Dryo and myself have played Myst, I'm assuming religiously. Me personally, I've played every single game in the Myst series, including the ill-fated Uru Live Myst Online.
You know, Uru is still live.
It is, and Uru Live is actually back on track, and I really want to get back to playing it. I'll explain why in a second. For those that have never played the Myst series, Myst is a series of games developed by Rand and Robin Miller in 1987. Basically, they're back in 1990 something or another. The company that was formed that did it was CN Worlds. CN is in like cyan.
I used to call it cyan. I think it's
CN Worlds. I've heard it pronounced CN Worlds before. I think it's because I've heard it pronounced that way because of the – maybe it's Cyan Worlds. I don't know. I thought CN. I've heard it pronounced at one point that way. Regardless of the fact, the game that they came out with was the game called Myst. Myst itself was this sort of revolutionary game in terms of it was a, you know, like much like we've talked about, a graphic adventure game. Now, prior to this, a lot of the games that came out from LucasArts, those being Tales of Monkey Island and things like that, were sort of at this, I think, halfway point, if you don't mind me saying, people, where you had a graphic world in front of you. But you still had a text interface underneath you. You still had certain keywords you could use to look around and do things. You
still
know.
Had verbs.
Exactly. And so what Myst did as a game in terms of actually things like that, it wasn't so much that you had verbs in front of you. You literally just said, you want to interact with this book? Just click it. Just you know, pull it there, rotate this there, and it was very, very much aware of that. It also took heavy advantage of the fact of the QuickTime, I guess for lack of better words, the QuickTime video
QuickTime movies,
and it made for
FFVs?
Exactly, and it made for full motion video, but it included them in the world. It made the characters of Atreus your main character, because essentially the character is you, and that's kind of the coolest part about Myst is usually within a graphic adventure game, it was always a third person view. You always saw your character. You saw, and in terms of LucasArts, you'd see your Guybrush Threepwoods of the world, and your
Maxes
and Sams, and I forget the Full Throttle guy. I can't remember. I'm blanking. It's one of my favorite guys. It'll come to me as we play the game, as we start talking discussion. But because of that, and it's not even so much that you're dropped in a world and like, okay, here's how you play the game. It's like, boom, you're in the world. Explore.
Go.
and it can be daunting, and if you're not prepared for that kind of game, especially now in this era, especially like now in the modern era of the tutorial level, which, by the way, wasn't around in our era, if that makes any sense. There's very few games that had the tutorial level. You kind of had to, you know, a lot of your point-and-click adventure games and your graphic games never had a tutorial. I don't think I've ever had a tutorial level in a graphic adventure.
Well, the start of Indiana Jones and Fate of Atlantis sort of was a tutorial. Kind of gave hints of what to do.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen hints. Hints is one thing, but the tutorial is like, here's how you use the interface.
Yeah, basically you're talking about like a full dedicated level that is nothing but teaching you the ropes
we start seeing that as games go on, and we'll get into modern games, modern companies in a second. But more importantly was that you were dropped in this world, and it was the Island of Myst, and you're walking around, you see a piece of paper that says something on the note to do X, Y, or Z. You kind of walk around, explore the island, do this. You end up, you know, seeing this man named Atreus talking to you through a video. And it's this sort of in world, and you get really enveloped and really involved. And because of the fact that it was such a monumental game, it actually like set records. I don't know if its record is still in effect, but I'm certain it isn't. But at the time, and for a long time after the fact,
hell yeah,
it was one of the best selling games for the time, and then so for a couple of years it took a long time to actually have the record broken in terms of stuff, and so it is one of those games as a legacy, though definitely not the first one in terms of stuff. I guess since we're talking about Cyan Worlds, we're talking about Myst, you might as well, you know, dig into Cyan Worlds first. Have you guys actually, beyond just Myst 1, have you played any of the other titles like Riven and Myst 3?
All of them.
Okay, so you played all of them.
Except for Uru.
Okay, so you're the non... I never played Uru. I just played Uru Live, and I'll get into all this in very, very shortly. But what I think I liked a lot about the Myst series, and even when it came to like 5, which is kind of this weird hybrid kind of thing, I liked the fact that the worlds and stories were as fleshed out as they were. Like I got so involved in the actual stories of the Dani. That's the sort of the race that makes the Myst worlds. For those, you know, kind of quickly sum up the flavor of Myst. Essentially,
spoiler alert,
and this is the flavor of it.
Oh no! If you haven't played Myst, then
I
know.
But that's why. Well, this is not spoiling so much.
Spoiler alert, clear.
Yeah. This is exactly, because this is so much more like, if you don't know the idea of Myst, the idea of Myst is that you essentially, as you explore Myst Island, you find these books that open up and have this sort of FMV little video on there that you click. And by the way, people, you can buy this on the iPhone. So if you've ever wanted to play Myst and or Riven, they're on the iPhone and they're phenomenally fun.
If you haven't played Myst or Riven, stop this podcast right now and go download it. I swear.
Yeah,
if you don't, you're dead to me.
Yeah. go buy on the iPhone. Go buy on the iPad. It's worth the purchase. But in any case, the books would open up and you'd be able to enter a new world. And these were linking books to the world. And you would learn, you know, the point is that – the culture that could do that in the book, the Dani, which I won't go into super detail because a lot of the stuff I know isn't so much in the movie than the movies, in the games themselves. It's actually in the books.
Oh, the books.
Which were really good, by the way, and were phenomenal. And because of all that, I think I get into a part of my life, a part of my thing where I'm like, you know what? I kind of want to play Myst. I should really play Myst again. I really want to play Riven again. You know what? I think it's time I beat Myst 3. And I think this is what happened to me because I never completed all the games for a while. And then I think I was at somewhere like a computer store going out of business, and they had for sale Myst 3 and Myst 4. I go, you know what? I haven't played Myst 3 and Myst 4 yet. I really should play Myst 3 and Myst 4. Or they had the collection or something like that. They had the collection. I bought the masterpiece and had like up to 4, and I think that I bought 5 separately. And I was like, you know what? I think it's time I go through all the Myst games again. And so I put in Myst 1, installed it, and I was like, oh, that's right. This is why I love the game. And then I got getting Riven, like, oh, yeah, that's right. I remember why I love this game again, and you know, different things. Then Myst 3 comes in, and I'd not played Myst 3, and I'd always read the reviews in terms of, like, that the world is different. It's 3. It's all motion. You rotate your camera around. I was like, that's poppycock. And then I
how can this be?
How can this be? You know,
impossible.
And this is at the height of the QuickTime panorama view, because everyone loved the panorama camera. Everyone loved the 360 camera back in like
VR panorama having.
Yes, everyone loved the QuickTime VR. Everyone freaking used that everywhere in the world.
But it worked really good in Myst 3.
Oh, God,
I mean,
it worked phenomenally in Myst 3.
Gorgeous, and the soundtrack. I mean. Mm-hmm. The whole thing.
Yeah, and it actually has one of my favorite kind of soundtracks for like, it had a villain.
Go ahead.
Riven, essentially the sequel to Myst, had a villain as well, but you know, he wasn't always apparent. He was sort of like, I'm the villain, and you're after me.
And if I can remember, I don't think he actually killed you in Riven, whereas in Myst 3, spoiler alert again, you can be killed by him. It's maybe it's suggested, I don't know. It's just
there's that scene, if you happen to get caught in the wrong thing and say the wrong thing, that you can get shot with a thing.
Okay.
I don't know. It's hard to explain. We're literally tiptoeing around things and everything else. I guess I'll go around since we are talking about Myst and the series and stuff. Dryo, since all of us have played every one of them except for Uru, and maybe Steven has played Uru, and we'll talk about that very shortly. Dryo, what was your favorite out of the series?
The original.
Really? No love for Riven, no love for Myst 4 with the oh God, who is it that did that song in there? Curtains, what was his name? Peter Gabriel, no love for the Peter Gabriel song?
It has to be the original.
Okay.
I liked all the other ones, but the original just was like, when I think back, it's like, I want to play a Myst game. Which one am I going to play? Myst. It's always the one I go back to.
Okay. That's a valid a totally a valid thing to talk about.
I don't know if it's just because I could probably finish it in one sitting now, but...
Well, yeah, I think for me, if I had to say my favorite, I'm going to be the outlier. I mean, I love the first one. I love Riven. I might have to say Myst 4. I think I liked Myst 4 a lot, mainly because I liked the soundtrack. I liked how it worked in video. And it developed... And this is told in the very get-go, the beginning of the game anyways. It develops the sons of Atreus and – not Atreus, sorry, of – oh, God, what are the sons of in the Myst world?
Cirrus and Aknar?
Cirrus and Aknar develops them a lot more, and I like that. And I enjoyed that those characters got a little bit more developed. I always enjoy when those characters – the thing is like they were kind of this weird – as you played Myst, you learn a little bit about them and more of what they had left versus what they are, and you know
they are bastards
and they are bastards, and it was interesting how they worked them back in terms of storyline. If it wasn't that one, I'd say then Myst 3, mainly because again I loved the villain in Myst 3. I loved that sort of this is the outcome of Myst 2 of Riven and what that means to the worlds of the linking books. And it's interesting. It's very, very kind of interesting way of how do you continue a story where, you know, where the end is kind of ambiguous in terms of what happens. All right, Steven.
Oh, favorite Myst game. I could easily default to the first Myst. For the same reasons too. When I think about Myst, I think about the first game, and Myst and Riven are kind of tied for first place because I do like a lot of the elements that are offered up in Riven, especially the soundtrack. I mean, I'm really big on video game soundtracks, and you take the Riven soundtrack. You can't really do it with the other ones. You might be able to get away with it with the Myst soundtrack, but you pop in the Riven's soundtrack, turn off all the lights, and just veg out, and it's just such a relaxing soundtrack. It's not in your face, it's not harsh, it's just in the background.
No, for and, sure. For sure.
And when you're playing Riven, a lot of the time you don't even consciously register the music playing. It's only afterwards you're like, you know, there was something about that, and then you go back and you play through it again, and you really start listening to music, and you're like, "Oh, so that's what that was." You know,
that's the great sign of any game soundtrack is when it's not interfering with the game, but you realize later that it's excellent.
Yeah, it's just woven, and I think, and that's the thing with all the Myst games. Now, I was really sad when Cyan announced that Myst 5 was going to be the last Myst, because I was like, "No more Myst, come on, guys." You say we're going to talk about Uru later.
You can't talk
about. Let's address the elephant.
Let's address the elephant in the room. You can't talk about Cyan, you know, Cyan Worlds without talking about Uru. Uru was actually the successor to the Myst world. It was sort of like, here is what happens in the modern, because it was literally, you know, it was called Uru for a reason, and I'll tell you why. And it was actually.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just thinking. You were talking about Uru there, and I was thinking, you know, it's not. I don't want to say it's a sequel, but it's kind of a spinoff of the second Myst book, Book of Tiana.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because Book of Tiana dealt with the whole idea of the Dunny underground in some desert on the planet or something like that. I can't even remember where
the irony of all that is you're a dead on, except the planet was ours.
Spoiler
because
alert.
Because literally Uru Live was the online Myst sort of thing. It was essentially I think it was what Uru was. I never played Uru to confirm this.
Yeah, Uru and Uru Live is basically Uru with MMO attached to it. So
with a server.
So basically you can play and interact with other people in the same worlds that you were playing in the solo game, because I think by the time Uru was actually released, didn't they ditch the multiplayer option and they just sold it as a standalone product?
They did, yeah. I think that's what they did. But yeah, but essentially Uru Live, you begin literally, and it's only if you've read the books that you know what this is. You believe you begin in the cleft, and it becomes very apparent you're in the cleft, because as you're walking around, you see telltale things from Riven and Denise things. I mean, like, you literally talk to a guy in a freaking, you know, RV camper. And it's such a weird thing to be, you know, introduced in this world. Like, I'm talking to a mother effer. Why is this guy in the Myst game?
Well, not just that, but I mean, it much like the first Myst, it kind of comes around full circle. When you start up, you create your character and you start your game, you are dropped in the desert. You're not even dropped near the trailer or anything. You're just dropped on the desert. You can see kind of like a mountainous thing, which is the cleft, out in the distance, and you have to run towards it, and that's when you find the trailer. So they, much like the original Myst game, they just drop you in there and they say, go.
I mean, definitely what the interesting was the idea that it was called Uru because you are you. You actually got to design your avatar character to look a certain way and interact a certain way. So you actually got to, if you wanted to, make yourself in the game for the first time. And I think the issue with it, because I like the idea of Uru. I like the concept of multiplayer puzzles. That isn't a bad concept. There's something to be said about that as a design idea. I think the issue was, I don't know, and this is what happened Uru Live when I played it on this is, you know, but back was on GameTap, for Lord's sakes.
Oh God.
I was kind of the reason why, like, the two reasons I paid for GameTap, and this is what's even funnier, was for Uru Live and the new Sam and Max Telltale games that are on there, which we will talk about today once we get beyond this Uru thing. We're going to we'll talk about everything like that. Was that nobody wanted to solve the puzzles. Like, it was kind of weird. I was like, I need, because I get to a puzzle, and it's like, you need two people. It was very apparent because it had two hands. I'm like, son of a, I got to pair up with somebody now. And so I'm, you know, going around, like the main area going, hey, does anyone want to pair? No, okay, I guess I'll just sit here too. And it got boring, and it was. I never had a friend who was a big enough fan of Myst and a big enough fan of that mechanic to play the game with. And I think that's what bugged me out was none of my friends ever wanted to play Myst online. It wasn't like, you know, everyone didn't have a GameTap account. And more importantly, if they're going to pay $15 a month, they're going to pay for, like, you know, World of Warcraft or Ultima Online or whatever, you know, what was ever out in the time. It was never like, let's all play Myst online and solve the puzzles of the Denis. Like, that never sounded fun to my friends.
It's because it's a different kind of game. Instead of your end all be all goal to, you know, kill the final boss or anything like that, Uru is purely a game of discovery. I mean, there are tons of books. I mean, you can read all the books that are strewn around the entire Dunny Underworld.
Yep.
And there's actual right. It's one of my minor geeky achievements is when I first played Myst, I read through every single book.
Oh, really? Wow.
Cover to cover.
Wow.
And which you know, you got to have a hell of a lot of patience to do that.
Yep.
But you learn so much, and then couple that with the three novels that came out. And then having it culminate in Uru, Uru really makes the world of Myst kind of more real. It's not more real, but it makes it real. Like,
it makes it more relevant. I mean, that was the thing that I enjoyed the hell out of, was it felt like, you know, that as much as the Myst worlds have, you know, essentially done their thing and have made the games visually there. What Uru did, I felt it actually made it alive, and I don't know why. I think it's because every time we've been playing these games, it's always been this sort of almost like you're looking at a 2D picture or a 3D picture every time, regardless of how many times you could rotate the camera and things like that.
Yeah.
But with Uru, when it came out, and that would be the engine they'd use for Myst 5, for example, kind of this weird hybrid version of it, where because of that, it made the world feel a bit more real. It made it feel a little bit different. Your character could jump. He could climb up ladders. He could, you know, he could do X, Y, or Z. He could hit buttons and interact with it. And you saw him hitting the button. You saw him doing this.
Yeah.
And I think it's that you have, you know, it's the idea of third versus, you know, first person. I felt a lot more connection with my third person character versus, you know, me being a first person each time. Mm-hmm. And again, there's something, you know, especially when playing, you know, in recent puzzle game like Portal 2, there's something to be said about solving a puzzle in tandem with somebody that I really wished I could have fully experienced, but just no one ever wanted to.
Well, yeah, I had the same exact problem too. Even when the live component was basically handled by fans, that's pretty much the only way Uru Live operates now, is just fans running their own servers and whatnot. But it's still really hit and miss to find anybody. Adding friends and whatnot is not as intuitive as you might like it to be. And the way the puzzles play out in terms of changing the various ages is kind of confusing. Because because the whole idea of changing ages in canon is also very confusing, because there's one group of people that say when you write a linking book, you're creating that world, whereas another group says, well, when you're writing that linking book, you are describing a world that already exists either in our dimensional plane or some other higher dimension or something like that.
Right.
So you got these two competing ideas of how the art actually works, and the rule set is just as complicated as the art itself. And I commend them for putting that layer of complexity into the game, but as a mechanic, it makes things very difficult to keep track of.
It does, and I think what always intrigued me a lot was in Live was that you'd have these sort of like different competing grounds of thought in terms of how to rebuild the Dene culture and things like that. And it was, that seemed really fascinating to me as a player, but every time I got on, none of those things were happening. And I don't know if I was on the wrong times or if I was in the wrong rooms.
No, it just wasn't happening. That, as far as I can remember, they had really, really big plans for Uru. And by the time it was released, it just fell apart.
And they ditched
the multiplayer. I can't remember who was the publisher, because I blame them for it, because
I don't know who published Uru. You got that? That would have to be I'm going to look really quick kind of thing, because I could not tell you. Uru: Age Beyond Mist was published by Ubisoft.
There you go.
There's your problem right there.
For a second there, I was going to say Activision, but I was like, no, it's not Activision. It's something, and then you said Ubisoft. I was like, yep. Now I know why I hate them.
Yeah,
it's still a great game. But if you can get past all of the complexity and the fact that there's not that many people playing it, and the software is a little buggy. So depending on what system you put it on, it may work, it may not.
It happens.
But yeah, they had these big plans and it just never panned out. If it did, oh man, I think Uru would have been. Uru could have been not a direct competitor to WoW, not even close.
No.
It would have been like a quieter, more peaceful WoW alternative, maybe.
It definitely would have been something. I'm not sure what that something was, but it would. I don't think it'd be a competitor to WoW per se. That's kind of. I mean, at that time, it was a very lofty goal, even for games that were similar or different. You know, even in the games like Tabula Rasa, made by Lord British himself, if you will. Even that was a lofty goal to try to compete. But that's an entirely different subject of talk.
Yeah, we are so geeking out.
It's okay.
I haven't played Ultimate Games in a while, and that's going to take a long time to catch up.
Yeah, that's an entirely one. But let us actually move on, since we brought up the idea of Sam and Max. We would be besmirched if we did not talk about the ever popular LucasArts. LucasArts, of course, as we all know, is a brand of Lucasfilms and all that fun stuff. But that doesn't matter, because we don't really care about the company itself, because the company doesn't matter. Because, you know, they now make
Star Wars games
and license out these Star Wars to Lego games and everything else. But what they made in the past, back in the day, if you will, and back in the early 90s and late 80s, were these graphic adventure games. Now, here's a question I'm going to ask you people before we even begin. What was LucasArts' initial graphic adventure game?
Maniac Mansion?
Incorrect.
No, it's gotta be earlier than that.
I was gonna say the exact same thing.
Labyrinth actually was their first one. Labyrinth is in terms of if you look at LucasArts adventure games according to Wikipedia, the first game on the list. Initial titles do include things like this. The LucasArts first adventure game was the 1986 title Labyrinth.
There it is.
And Labyrinth, the computer game, is a graphic game inspired by Jim Henson's fantasy film Labyrinth. The game was developed by Lucasfilms Games, now LucasArts, and published by Activision in 1986 for the Apple IIe and Apple IIc, Commodore 64, 128, and MSX2. It was the first adventure game to be developed by LucasArts like LucasArts Development House, and as such can be seen as a more primitive precursor development to the Scum engine. Now, I think the first official Scum title was Maniac Mansion, to be honest. So that was the first Scum game. Scum, for those out there who are wondering, like, what the heck? What are you talking about, Scum? That's not a Scum game. That's a beautiful game, sir. Why would you besmirch its name? No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the engine, the Scum engine, one of the more popular LucasArts engines, and by far one of the most ingenious ways to speed up game development, if I don't mind saying. The Scum engine stands for Script Creation Utility for Maniac Mansion. Hence why it's from the first game, Maniac Mansion. It's a scripting language developed at LucasArts to ease development of the graphical adventure game Maniac Mansion. It falls somewhere between a game engine and a programming language, allowing designers to create locations, items, and dialogue sequences without writing code in the language in which the game's source code ends up. So essentially, it was literally middleware before there was middleware, which is kind of interesting. Because you essentially, if you think about a game like Maniac Mansion, for example, it came out in PC, and it came out on the NES. And because of that...
NES version had stuff taken out of it, but...
It did, because of graphics for limitations, but it was still a Scum-based game at that point. It was still Scum doing that. It wasn't like they reported it. They did it to kind of, you know, to make sure they could port it to things like, you know, obviously your eardrum platform, the 3DO. Apparently they had it on the TurboGrafx 16, which I had no idea, some things like that. Scum has been released on the following platforms. So if we read the platforms it's been on. 3DO, Amiga, Apple II, Atari ST, CDTV, Commodore 64, Fujitsu Towns and Marty, which I'd never heard of, Apple Macintosh, Nintendo Entertainment System, Disk Operating System, aka DOS, Microsoft Windows, Sega Mega CD, and TurboGrafx-16/PC Engine.
So pretty much... No Tandy supercomputers.
So basically, Scum titles have been everywhere. And to kind of give some notable series titles, just to kind of kick off the discussion, if you will, and then trust me, I'll ask what your favorite game is in terms of this. I won't go into what your favorite LucasArts game is, because the thing is that we'll get into all that in this very second, but some notable titles that were done in the Scum engine, for those that have no idea, Maniac Mansion, of course, being the initial one, and its sequel, Day of the Tentacle. Mm-hmm. Loom, the Monkey Island series, pretty much as a full, except for Escape from Monkey Island, which I will get to that later. The Full Throttle, Sam Max Hit the Road, and The Dig. Now I have a question. Has anyone other than me played The Dig?
I have not.
No, I haven't.
I am the only one that's played The Dig. The Dig is the most bizarre LucasArts game. It's somewhere between, what if there was an asteroid that was out in the middle of space that's coming towards Earth, and it wasn't going to kill us? I think it's essentially like somewhere in between, like I guess for lack of a better, it's a more educational Armageddon, and it's a more thinking Armageddon. You know, if Armageddon was actually a thinking movie and didn't have a soundtrack done by Aerosmith,
or directed by Michael Bay,
was it directed by Michael Bay?
I think so.
Oh God, I mean, that answers everything, because I totally forgot about the movie. But the basic concept behind a Scum title, I think, is you'd have this graphical component, of course, and for the most part, you know, as the engine evolved, it started going away from clicking, like we told in the original Tales
clicking
of
the
Island
verbs.
And the verbs. It would go away from that, and just so much clicking and then picking the action you're going to do, like you click on the tailpipe and you grab it versus, you know, grab tailpipe and things like that. So I'm going to ask, and at this point, you know, I'm going to ask a very broad question in terms of this, and if we get to talking about another engine because of that, I don't care, because it's I think we need to approach this as a whole. I'm going to start with Steven. Your favorite LucasArts adventure game?
My favorite LucasArts adventure game.
Or the one that when you think LucasArts adventure games, this is the game that comes to mind.
I think I'm going to steal whatever you might have as your favorite or your notable one. And that is Grim Fandango.
Ooh, yeah, that's not my notable one, but that is a good one because I got to first before we continue. Grim Fandango is one of those games that I have never played.
And, what? Shame on you! Shame.
And much like everything else, it's the game that I know I need to play, and I've seen playthroughs of that. I go, crap! That is like the game written for me. It's a film noir.
Let me get this straight. It is 2012, and the game came out in 1998.
Do you know how hard it is to find that game? And I'm the kind of guy. Yeah, it is because this is the funny thing about Grim Fandango. Grim Fandango, for those out there, it was this, you know, and I know that the style of it's a film noir esque game. It's actually was done in its own engine called the Grim Engine, which is hilarious. And it's sort of the successor to the successor to the Scum Engine. It was sort of 3D graphics. You could have audio in there, and I think you actually coded it in Lua, which was a really cool scripting language at the time. Still is a cool scripting language right now. But in any case, Grim Fandango was this film noir game that had a Dios de los Muertos kind of look, where you had these sort of if you're ever familiar with the Mexican holiday Dios de los Muertos. You know, the look of kind of the skulls and sort of the artistic look and had to deal with actually the afterlife. And it, as opposed to dealing with it in like a, you know, it's sort of this sort of holy thing. It dealt with it like you would a film noir movie where you had, you know, murder and intrigue and mystery and things like that. And I'd always heard of the title and I guess I just never bought it. And now, because, you know, LucasArts hasn't really, you know, good old games apparently can't get rights to those games because they haven't released it. And it's such a rare title in terms of like coming in my peripheral in terms of where I can buy it. We have a local store called Game Over Video Games that does used games. It literally is such a rare title and such a wanted title that I've told the owners, like, unless you guys haven't had this PC game, like, and one of the guys who was working behind the shelves, like, if that game comes through, I got first dibs in purchasing it. I'm like, which is okay. It's totally notable. It's totally understandable. And it's that title that I missed, and those happen. And sometimes I can revisit titles, and thanks to good old games, I can really revisit titles. But for some reason, it just they don't put it on there. It's not on there. It's like Lucas is like kind of tucked it away, and it's kind of a shame because as I'm looking through the playthroughs of the game and seeing the visual look and the story, I'm like, God, this game was written for me. This has everything I love in a game. This is the kind of game I want to play now.
No, I gotta ask: did either Steve or Steven, did you ever encounter the bug where if your computer was too fast, you could not get the secret in the elevator?
I heard about the bug, but I never experienced it myself.
So there is this bug. If there is this part, the part of the game is where you have to put you have to enter an elevator with a forklift, hit the up button, and get the forklift into the door while it's going up. And if your computer was too fast, you would actually go up before you could actually complete the objective.
Wow, that's it's weird.
Yeah.
So what I had to do is I had to actually underclock my computer.
No.
Oh, man, that's hardcore right there.
That's hardcore. I would never have thought about even doing that. I mean, I could try to pirate it if I wanted to. And I've thought about it. I've thought about pirating the game. But I mean, the thing is that I know I'd have to do a lot of work because of how the game was designed. Like, I'd literally have to, from what I've heard, I'd have to run a VM, lower its CPU to a CPU of that era, install Windows 95 on that same machine, and then install Grim Fandango.
Okay, Roberto. Here's what you need to do when you make your VM machine. System requirements for Grim Fandango are as follows: a 133 megahertz processor.
Oh God.
32 megabytes of RAM. Holy crap. 30 megabytes of hard disk space and a 4 megabyte video card.
Wow.
And back in 98, that would probably set you back a couple grand.
Wow, God, it's been.
The machine I'm sitting on right now has 6 gigs of RAM.
Oh God,
and it's still freaking slow.
I've got eight gigs of RAM in my machine right now. I can make the VM and my computer goes, well, we're like, okay, that's kind of a little portion of maybe a core. Here you go.
Maybe, yeah, just a teeny bit. Yeah.
The thing is, like, I'm afraid that if I don't do that, it'll just go like, oh, you've got this badass computer. Here you go. Boom. And just like zip through. Like,
I think Firefox takes up more CPU than
it does. It does. Yeah.
than 133.
That's insane. I mean, because the thing is that a lot of these games, especially look at the requirements, especially now, you look at the requirements like Full Throttle or Monkey Island or Salmon Max.
How many floppies did Full Throttle come on?
Oh, I got lucky and I got the first game I played, and I got lucky because
you got the talkie version.
It came with the sound card and it was on a CD-ROM.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it was. I got the fun one. I got to hear oh God, what's his name? Shoot, it's gonna bug the crap out of me. This is how my brain works, is that if I don't know the guy's name from Full Throttle, I know the guy that made it was Tim Schafer. That's kind of what I remember off the top of my head. Was Tim Schafer that made it. Tim Schafer, let's see.
While you're looking at that, you know, one of the things, kind of wrapping it up, you know, with Myst and Riven and now Grim Fandango, one of the common thread that kind of made these games so amazing back then when we first saw them was the fact that they were using CD-ROMs. So now you have, you know, full motion video, have stereo sound, you have all
you
these
have
things.
Speaking.
You have, yes, yeah, you actually have characters speaking at you.
And that was the big thing, was that when the CD-ROM got invented. I mean, even in the Myst series, the first Myst, for example, you know, no one was voiced. I mean, the first Monkey Island, no one was voiced. I think it wasn't until, was it 3? Or
3, yeah. 3. And 3 was probably – 3 to me was probably the funniest Monkey Island.
Well, yeah, because you actually had a voice to Guybrush Threepwood. You had a voice to, like, you got introduced to a lot of the vocal characters that would be later used in the Tales series, like, you know, Murray, the undead, you know, demon.
My favorite character of any LucasArts game is Murray.
Murray is fun.
Murray, the talking skull.
Murray. I personally like Glottis from Grim Fandango.
Oh, that's right. There was
the mechanic.
That's the mechanic. Right. Yeah.
Worked on the car. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because the thing is that, you know, what made a lot of LucasArts games then as the graphic adventure games great was that there were characters remembered. And I finally remember the name of Ben. Yes. Ben from Full Throttle. God, I could talk about this game specifically. Full Throttle was a game actually made by Tim Schafer, who Tim Schafer, by the way, is now a very, you know, at that time still prominent, now is a very prominent game designer. I mean, you can throw Tim Schafer and people, you know, your modern day kids who have no idea about the games of yore know who the hell Tim Schafer is. Because you're like, oh, that's the guy that made this game or that game, or, oh, you mean the guy that did Psychonaut? Like, kids of now know who Tim Schafer is.
He did Day of the Tentacle.
He did Day of the Tentacle too, which I've also not played, and I feel bad about myself for not playing.
Oh, come on. What are you doing on this topic, Ben?
I'm just saying, like there's certain games I've come late to. I finally played Hit the Road and things like that, and I've come late, you know. I came late to some styles, I'm not going to lie. I was a kid that, you know, at that time of the games, I just never purchased games. I didn't have the currency to purchase games, and my parents didn't always want to buy me PC games. And
I think that's where I was lucky, whereas I got mostly hand-me-downs from my father.
And that's why. And my dad didn't play, you know, video games. And, you know, so I at the early times when we got PCs, I got Full Throttle because it was introduced with a sound card. And I was like, this is awesome. This is a great game. And I played it like at least 3 or 4 or 5 times, you know, just having the game itself. And later on in as life, as I've gotten older, I've played things like the Sam Max Hit the Road, the Monkey Island series, and things like that. And along the way, there are certain titles I missed. I did play The Dig before I bought it on Steam, and I did play that. And I know of a lot of the titles. I think that's the problem, is that a lot of the things, what was interesting about the LucasArts world is a lot of those titles, you know, in terms of humor and references, sometimes would blend. and almost become, not become one per se, but there'd be certain, you know, kind of gags that would have had. What was that?
There were nods, like in Day of the Tentacle, there was pictures of Sam and Max in the oldie times.
Exactly. And so, you know, and even then, I knew of Maniac Mansion, and I played in the NES, but never played the PC game. And I knew of Day of the Tentacle. Like, I know a lot of those gags, and I just never played them, and it happens that way. But regardless of that fact, that was, I think, one of the golden eras of sort of LucasArts. To kind of now go, you know, on to that, and I'm moving on to this because this is something I have actually never ever played. I don't think I've ever played a Sierra graphic adventure game.
And there, the biggest difference between Lucas and Sierra was that in Sierra you died
really
a lot.
Interesting. Have you ever played,
especially in the early games?
So I know, Steven, have you ever played a Sierra adventure game before?
Steven
might be gone. Steven might.
I think I was muted. Honestly, I can't remember. I cannot remember.
That would include things
not.
Like the King's Quest series, the Space Quest series, and Leisure Suit Larry, which I find very fascinating that Sierra made.
Okay, now I know Leisure Suit Larry, and I do know Space Quest. I might have played a little bit of Space Quest, but that was such a long time ago.
Here's a question for you, Dryo. What was the first Sierra graphic adventure games that they made?
Oh, jeez.
Let's see how your history works, good sir. Because apparently it was the high-res series, where it was literally these very, very primitive graphic adventure games.
It's got to be before King's Quest, but I don't know what it would be. It was King's Quest?
No, it was before King's Quest. It was high-res adventure. And then it includes all seven graphic games released by the company prior to the release of the company's landmark King's Quest. So this is all before King's Quest happened. And then came King's Quest. You're going to have to explain what King's Quest is because, like I said, I'm not a Sierra guy.
King's Quest was basically about this knight called Sir Graham. And through the course of this adventure where if – the controls were really bad, and if you fell off, it was really easy to fall off edges and die. You became the king, and the following games followed his quest for a wife and his family.
Interesting. So, because every other game, I mean, okay, I guess I have to approach this Easter egg. For those people who never played Monkey Island, here's an Easter egg for you. At one point in the game, Guybrush Threepwood says, "I can hold my breath underwater for 10 minutes." If there is a point in the game where you're thrown underwater, if you hold if you stay underwater for more than 10 minutes, you will die. There you go.
Nope. If you fall in water, you die in King's Quest.
Really? Wow.
Wow.
It wasn't even like a, "Oh, here you go, you're dead."
And the games had these illogical puzzles sometimes, and sometimes if you solve the puzzles wrong, where you use an item, later in the game where you needed that item, you were screwed.
Really?
Oh. Yeah, seriously? They had no win situations in there.
That's kind of cruel. I mean,
yeah.
Wow. So you couldn't go back and like get another one of those items or whatever.
Nope.
Oh my god.
You were stuck. There were points in the game where you could not continue any farther.
And
you wouldn't even get a game over or anything. You're just stuck forever.
Yep. It's like, what can I do now?
So what was the appeal?
And this was before the internet, so you didn't know if you were stuck.
What the? Oh.
So what was the appeal then? Like especially, you know, as a gamer, you must get frustrated every time. Like, what was the appeal? Was the story that good?
You got invested into that game. Once the first two games, you're like, okay, I want to know more about him. And this was going good until the eighth game, which is almost never talked about.
Obviously, the King's Quest series, they don't have a ton of games, much like every other good series in terms of sequels. Because I guess that's the only reason why you would play it is that it just the story just involves you so much that you're like, I must keep playing. I must know the story about this guy. Which I guess that's valid because I would get so frustrated. Like I hit a puzzle, like, what, you mean to tell me I need that item I used like five puzzles ago and I don't have a save for it anymore? Mother, I would just like throw the computer across the room.
And I guess the other appeal is, whereas LucasArts was very had very broad comedy. All of Sierra games were had really a dry wit.
Yeah, I can imagine it because it's, you know, obviously King's Quest is in a fantasy world. You know, I'm betting there's a lot of English accents to be thrown around. Whereas a lot of LucasArts games were very funny, poignant, and kind of hilarious. You know, funny games. You have like Sam and Max series, which is hilarious. And even The Dig had some funny things, but it was mainly a serious game. Whereas I always knew the King's Quest to be that kind of seriously hardcore game. I think I didn't play because at the time I was never attracted to that. If you want
to get into it and you really don't care about too much about the story, I'd say play the seventh game.
Okay,
The Princess Bride.
I might have to try that. I guess I've heard
the style, the artwork is very Don Bluthy.
Oh, okay, yeah. I think you showed me that and it looked that way. But we're pretty much almost out of time, and I think it's time that we move on to the future. Now, for those out there who have no idea, there's a lot of people that say the graphic adventure game is dead.
They're not dead.
No. A lot of people do say it's dead. A lot of people say it's dead, and you can't make it in this modern day
age.
It
just went to Germany.
It didn't go to Germany. It actually went to a little town in little area called San Francisco, California, and it's had a lot of resurgence in the past, especially with the recent Tim Schafer. Crazy. I mean, this is before this, but it's got a lot of like talk now because Tim Schafer, you know, the guy who we talked about that made Full Throttle, happens to have a little game company called Double Fine Games, and currently, he actually started a Kickstarter. Kickstarter is the sort of service that lets you try to raise money for a project. And he wanted to make a 2D adventure game. He's like, and I know I can make it, but wait, what if I get people to pay for it, you know, already, and raise a certain amount of money? And I think he made what, like 2 million, maybe more so far.
3.3, I think.
3.3 million, something along the line. Some astronomical amount, the biggest Kickstarter amount to date, and it was insane. And I don't know if it's because he's Tim Schafer, pitched in, or because it was a graphic adventure game that everyone wanted to pitch in because everyone wants to play this.
Didn't he get all that didn't he surpass the amount he was asking for in the first couple hours?
He went full and beyond. But even then, like I would be remiss with, you know, without even talking about him, he's just sort of a mention right now. I would be terrible to, you know, without bringing up who I think is the company that is continuing the spirit of LucasArts, the spirit of graphic adventure games, and bringing them into the modern era as 3D games, if you will. And surprisingly enough, they are ex-LucasArts people. That would be one of my favorite indie studios on the planet, Telltale Games. Telltale Games they're based out of San Rafael, California, and they essentially brought back graphic adventure games and did it right in terms of what needed to be done for the era that came out, for our modern era. They actually, you know, whereas people have like tried to do the old episodic game sort of thing, they did the whole episodic game sort of thing and actually did it right. And they did it with a very, very, very popular LucasArts series, that being Sam and Max. So anyone that can bring back Sam and Max gets a props in my head. And
I was amazed when I heard they got it because I knew LucasArts never gave up their licenses.
Well, because the cool thing was that the beautiful thing about Sam and Max is that when the guy left, you know,
Cell,
whenever he walked away, and Sam and Max, the 3D sequel that never came out and that will never ever come out. What was it called?
Freelance Police.
Freelance Police. In fact, there's a joke within the series of Sam and Max. You know, I think it's the second season one or two, where they're at the they've gone through the Bermuda Triangle and they're in like one of the islands there that of like things that shouldn't be or things that have got lost to time. There's a pile of junk and in there a bunch of boxes of Sam and Max Freelance Police, which is hilarious, like beta copies or beta versions of it. It's hilarious.
There was another nod in the first season where it's like on a calendar with a date marked where it was canceled.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny. It's a funny nod. But in any case, what they did was, like I said, Supercell made sure that after all that happened, he still kept the rights to the characters of Sam and Max. And because of that, is why Telltale can make the games. And you know, they made the games because I guess GameTap took a chance, because you know, GameTap was this sort of online service, much like we're talking about when it came to the whole Uru Live sort of thing. They had made the idea that you could you know, get this episodic game of Sam Max. It was their kind of thing, that every month would be a new episode of Sam Max. And so Telltale decided to go down this episodic route where they'd make, you know, a self-contained episode of a game that would, you know, kind of continue this whole longer storyline, and would let you kind of play a game piecewise. And because, you know, Purcell was on the writing staff, on the design staff, everything in terms of humor in Sam Max was spot on. Everything was perfect in terms of the world Sam Max. You saw your familiar things like the DeSoto. You saw some newer things and newer characters introduced in terms of like Bosco and I forgot the girl's name, that the Everpop. What was her name?
My problem is they showed Flint. They shouldn't have showed Flint.
They shouldn't. They later on showed Flint, but even then, it made for a funny gag. You know? No,
he was always heard, but he was never seen in the comics.
I mean, you're right, I guess. But overall,
I'm not gonna complain.
I'm not gonna bust their balls over some bullshit. I'm not that kind of fan, Dryo, where I'm like, oh my god, they showed Flint, your mother. Like, I'm like, I don't give a damn, because ultimately, it made for a funny gag. It made for a fun joke. It made for like a, hey Flint, how's it going? I'm on my next case. Like this sort of like classic, you know, much like in the series, because you're essentially playing as in the Sam Max series, you're playing as Sam and Max. Sam is this bipedal dog, talking creature. With a fedora and kind of a business suit, and you have Max, a naked bunny like thing with a gun,
lagomorph
with a gun, if you will, a luger, if you will, and they've essentially with no pockets, and essentially they have called themselves freelance police. They've just declared themselves, we're freelance police. We don't give a damn.
Answer only to the commissioner.
Only to the commissioner, and it's such a, and even as things got later, but it's such a great thing that they're like, we're freelance police, we're just doing whatever the fuck we want, and it's so, you know, it's literally a very fun romp in terms of like your crime dramas and your kind of, you know, your things like that. And so what made the Telltale games, made them popular, made them super, super fun, because everyone was like, oh my god, Sam Max is back, yay! And so they started making a lot and started making seasons. They would later be given, and this is the big one, because LucasArts did own this one, they would be given the license, and I am amazed that Lucas gave them the license on this one, but I'm so glad they did, because they would then revisit another LucasArts series, The Tales of Monkey Island. They were actually
Did they sell it to him, or did they lease it?
They leased it. You saw the Telltale logo and you saw the LucasArts logo. The LucasArts kept that, but holy crap, was that hilariously awesome! Because
I was so happy when Murray showed up.
I was super happy too. I was so pleased, and even in general, I was just happy just to see this game. Like, oh my god, this is awesome! And so, you know, and that time there was also the re-release of the new version of Monkey Island, complete with the voice acting that wasn't obviously done in the first one, because we had a voice for Guybrush and things like that. And so they did a great job in terms of getting good voice actors too, and in general for the games. But even on that regard, it's not like Telltale isn't making just revamp properties of things. They're also making new games. Have you guys ever played the Hector Badge of Carnage series yet of theirs?
No, I have not.
No.
Hector Badge of Carnage might in fact be the most awesome thing that's ever been designed. It's basically a for lack of better words, a British-esque crime drama with like your typical hard-ass British cop going through a point-and-click adventure game. Like, this guy that should be from the 70s is like, if you watch the trailer for it, when you get a chance to check out the trailer for it, it's literally this. Oh, okay, that's the joke. Like, if in terms of, you've ever seen the series Life on Mars, imagine if Gene Hunt was a point-and-click adventure game series. And take that to that extreme, and it makes for the funniest game, because it's just it is bizarre as hell, but it's great. But even then, they've made their own kind of things where they've had, you know, the Puzzle Agent series, where it's sort of, you know, Professor Latham meets, you know, Fargo and X-Files and make a graphic adventure game out of that. And so it makes for...
Fargo? Like the movie?
Yes, like the movie. You have to play the game to understand. But, you know, even then, they have actually licensed properties where they've made their own, you know, they've made games based on properties that don't even have point-and-click adventure games associated with them. Specifically, the Strong Bad's Cool Game for Attractive People. They made the Homestar Runner point-and-click adventure game. Have you guys ever played that game yet? Or I'm assuming you're familiar with Homestar Runner at least.
Yeah, Homestar.
I think I remember that from high school. But
Homestar Runner.
I was just going to say that too.
Homestar Runer is still a site still around. Go to homestarrunner.com, people. Is a... for lack of better words, it was something the brothers Chap had made. It's this series of characters, Homestar and Strong Bad and things like that. But in any case, during the beginning of it, during the tail end of its sort of popularity, if you will, and even them, that's not really that unpopular. People like I can still bring up Homestar and people know who the hell they are. They made the point-and-click adventure game, which was Strong Bad's Cool Game for Attractive People. It was an episodic game. It was a fun game. And it had a lot of it was written by the brothers Chap and designed by them and, you know, programmed by Telltale. And it had all the humor of the show, the internet series, and internet cartoons, and it was awesome. It was definitely a fun kind of game. More recently, Telltale has made the Back to the Future the game.
Yep. Oh yeah.
Which was in terms of like the movies, I love, you know, 1, 2, and 3. This I consider the fourth movie. Like, I consider the game itself the fourth movie. I consider it like this is what where the story would have gone, and I love the way they did it. It was such a, as a guy that's played that loved the Back to the Future game, that loved the Back to the Future movies, that enjoyed the world, enjoyed the characters. I loved the game. I loved the point and click adventure game. I thought it was great.
The voices so right.
Oh yeah, obviously they cast in one of the original guys, that being of course Doc Brown, voiced by Christopher Lloyd. But when it came to Marty
McFly,
What's his face?
Michael J. Fox.
Michael J. Fox declined, but he did give the ability to use his likeness. In fact, because it was so cool, actually, the first initial sales, $1 of each sale was donated to the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's disease, which was actually really kind of cool. But they happened to cast this great guy, AJ LoCascio, that literally does a spot-on voice.
It's kind of creepy, actually.
Creepy.
He probably does a better McFly voice than
Marty himself. Well, because Lloyd heard it, and he's like, that's fucking Michael. Like Lloyd apparently was like blown away.
I don't
away.
Think Michael could get that squeaky of a voice now.
No, he couldn't, and that's okay. And the thing is that LoCascio, like, thank God, and I realized that when he was interviewed by Angry Video Game Nerd, Cinemassacre, that he's actually a nerd like us. Like, he is actually a geek like us, to the point where like there's a video where Angry Video Game Nerd is something else, and LoCascio's walking by like, do you know who this guy is? This is the Angry Video Game Nerd. This is James fucking Rolfe. And it's like, I would have said the same thing. I'm like, that is awesome. Like, LoCascio is this cool guy, and he realized in the interview that he is purely a dork, and he loves the series of movies. He watched a lot of these things as a kid, and he grew up with this stuff. And so him being in the game pretty much makes me really happy, because it was very respect to the property. It didn't cheapen it. It was definitely done with love, and if you're a fan of the series, and even if you're new to the series, it was awesome. It did everything the movie did. And
how could you be new to the series? Has anyone not seen Back to the Future?
I literally introduced Back to the Future to a friend of mine maybe a couple months ago. And if you ever wanted to know, if you ever show the first Back to the Future, whether it holds up in terms of like suspense near the end, let me tell you, it does. She was like on the edge of her seat, even though she knew there were two more movies afterwards coming up. She was still on the edge of her seat as the last part goes. She loved the film. So it turns out Back to the Future holds up as a film, not, you know, 20 years later, for Lord's sake, like almost, you know, at least 20 years, maybe almost 30 years later, for Lord's sakes.
We'll see how the second movie does in a few years.
We'll see, but for sure, the first one holds up, and it's that. But
2015.
Yep.
We got three more years for flying cars.
We're, I just have one question. Where the fuck is my hoverboard?
We all wonder that. But the point is the games themselves were great. But, you know, Telltale doesn't stop there. They license games like series like the Jurassic Park. They're currently licensing the Walking Dead games. And apparently
– and Carl will still not go into the house.
And there is a talk – no, I don't know if anything's been confirmed as of yet because I haven't checked recently, but there was talks that Telltale may make another King's Quest title.
What?
That's the rumor. That's the bubblings. I don't know whether that's been confirmed or not, but that's the.
That would be amazing if they could get Sierra to agree to that.
That's in the bubbles. I don't even know who owns Sierra at this point, to be honest. That's the question. Who owns Sierra?
Oh, yeah, Roberto. You know, adventure games are dead.
Of course they are.
They're all dead.
They're all dead, and Tim Schafer made made $3.3 million for nothing.
Yeah.
Since we're pretty much out of time and the hour is up and we've had discussion, let's kind of go a closing point. I'm going to go to each one of you, and I want you to tell me – after this whole entire discussion, after we've talked about different companies, different futures, things like that, if you could define an emotion that comes to you when you play an adventure game, whether it be Cian, whether it be Sierra, or LucasArts, or their successor Telltale, in maybe five emotions or less. How you feel when you see that game boot up, whatever game it is, whether it be a Sam Max, whether it be Full Throttle, essentially your favorite game. We'll go with you, Steven, first.
Five. Does it have to be five?
Five or less.
You can
sum it. Basically, it's to sum up your everything that makes adventure games to you what they are. If you can't say it in five words, you can go on longer.
Well, I would pretty much say when it comes to adventure games, both the old and the new, they take me back to when I was a kid and all those good things when I was a kid. First booting up Myst, first booting up Grim Fandango, things like that. It takes me back to a better time, a more, a simpler time.
When a man took his mouse and put it
on. Exactly. I was going to say, a time before I had to pay bills and all that shit, but, and actually go out and get a job, that kind of thing. But yeah, it's just kind of like that happiness that is wrapped up in that nostalgia. And I felt it, when I played Back to the Future, I went right back there, even though it's a modern game.
Well, especially because the intro is the first,
Exactly. Yeah.
And I'll say this before I even continue. If ever Telltale happens to hear this podcast for some bizarre reason, thank you for having the serious shit line in there. Thank you so much for putting that there. Because I was like, Telltale's never cursed before. I know it's coming up, but Telltale's never cursed before. They've never cursed before. They have never put a swear word in their games. Are they going to – and then like, when this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're going to see some serious shit. I was like, yes! They did
it. I did the exact same thing too.
I was so like – because I knew I played a Telltale game at that point. I'm like, they've never cursed before.
What was the rating on it? Was it just like
– it was T. I don't think so. I mean, because they never cursed in a point-and-click adventure game. The only time they ever like had cursing was during the whole poker night of the inventory, because you can't have Taika without a curse word. It's kind of an oxymoron. All right.
Yeah, and I think they're going to have to start cursing with The Walking Dead.
No, of course they are. All right, Dryo. Sum it up.
What I feel when I play adventure games. Jeez.
Well, I mean, like, not even feel so much. It's just sort of like your cap. If you have to put a bookend all this sort of discussion that we've had when it comes to this, because we've talked about a lot of different ideas in that. We've talked about 3D
discovery,
play, discovery, exploration. Oh, discovery, really? Okay, there you go.
Yeah, discovery. Just finding new things, clicking every item with every other item just to see what they say.
That's a good point. That's actually a really good way to sum it up. Discovery would be the thing. I guess for me, and it's not even because I don't love the Myst series, as I said before, I do. I think for me, when I think of graphic adventure games, I think of humor. I'm always a big fan of the Sam and Max. I'm a huge fan of a lot of the LucasArts stuff. And I think what attracted me, I mean, 'cause that was the first one I played. I think what attracted me at the beginning was the humor, was this sort of humorous way of telling a story and still making a fun game and still making a difficult game. Whereas, you know, when I got introduced to Myst, at that point in time, when I finally actually got a copy of Myst, because I never was given one until later on in life, I was definitely older, and I realized this is a different kind of game than what LucasArts was doing. But I guess, ultimately, when it comes to adventure games, I can say humor, you can say discovery, you can say going back to a simpler time. It's a culmination of a lot of things. It's the idea behind the game is that whether you're traveling through the worlds of Denis, or you're just going to the biggest ball of what was the freaking Sandman, the crazy
biggest attraction? Ball of twine in Minnesota.
Yeah, the biggest ball of twine in that, or you're just going down to Bosco's to get totally ripped off and buying some stupid little tin hat that protects you from the mind waves, because that's what Bosco does.
Because I keep increasing my prices and you keep paying them.
Exactly. or in that regard, whether you're apparently falling to your death in the King's Quest series and getting screwed over because you used that item 8 puzzles ago. What makes adventure games fun is that, the discovery, the exploration, the humor, the writing. It's what makes, what makes good games in general. But I think what makes it different from every other game is because it's the first time, it's one of the few times in games that there does not need to be an additional mechanic to do an interactive story and to have one that you kind of have to work to play. There doesn't need to be a platforming mechanic. There doesn't need to be a shooting mechanic. There doesn't need to be a create unit mechanic or even anything else beyond just the I have this object, this is the key to something, where does this key go? Well, that looks like a diamond, that there's a square on this key and there's a square on that door, perhaps this key goes with that door, and you open the door and you open up somewhere like, wow, this is a weird room, what are all these colors here? Well, they must mean something. Maybe if I walk around more, hey, there's a color screen here. Well, they also do the same thing too. Well, that's a bit bizarre. I wonder how this all works out. And you keep walking around and exploring, and you open up this world as you do so. And there's no other additional mechanic in terms of, like, you need to watch out for fuel, or your air is getting low, and you need to, go to a bubble or something like that. And there's very few times in games where – I mean, there's a lot of storytelling in games now, but there's very few times where there's another just the story – and you're kind of in the world interacting with it, and there's not another above it mechanic to deal with. Even in an open world game like L.A. Noire or anything like that, you still have the mechanic of driving, of guns, and sort of thing, and side quests. Whereas in a graphic adventure game, there's nothing beyond the fact that you are playing this story, you are involved in this world, you are exploring it to your heart's content, and you can take as little time or as long a time as you'd like. And as you explore, as you click around, as you discover, you find out a lot, and it makes for a very, very enjoyable game type. And if you've never ever played a graphic adventure game, especially for my younger listeners, Look around for LucasArts games on Good Old Games. Look around for your games like Full Throttle, Monkey Island. Go to Telltale Games and download the first episode. There's a free episode of the Sam Max series, by the way, so you can play it for free. You can try it out and see see what the hell we're all talking about. What these old fogies are talking about on them old days of gaming, and experiences, because I still think. And the more I look at the iPhone, and the more I look at the way the interface is, like, the iPhone itself lends itself to have a point-and-click adventure game on there,
And the new iPad, the screen, you could get so much on there.
But yeah, I'm saying it lends itself because the mechanic is what we point and click with our finger all the damn time in the iPhone on the touch screen. And so, you know, I think what game designers, especially on the iPhone, a lot of them lack is the idea of figuring out how to translate a game into the world of the touchscreen. And for some reason, I'm surprised. There's very few people that have. I mean, thankfully, Telltale has kind of put them on there. But and Seeing Worlds, you know, it really occurred to me when I played Myst again on my iPhone that I was like, this is exactly the platform it needs to be. And I think that's where, you know, that's where future games will be on that one. But anyways, we are fully out of time. Steven Dreil, thank you for joining me today. Steven, tell people where they can find you online.
They can find me on Twitter. That's at Arcalys, ArcHaelys. And that's pretty much where I hang out. So,
awesome. Dryo, where can they find your paranoid schizophrenic?
You can find me on Twitter at Dryosynth, and that's DRIOSENTH, or at Google+, the same thing. Because you cannot find me on Facebook.
Right, because you can't, because Facebook won't let you use Dryosynth. I don't know. Maybe it will.
No, they do. I just don't have anything on there.
Fair enough. Of course, you can find me. I'm at Vincent404 there on the Twitters. If you want to add me to Google+, just look at my name, Roberto Villegas. It's the easiest way to find me. If you haven't liked this episode you're listening to right now at this very moment in time, go ahead and comment on the website, mysocial8bitlife.com. You'll also find links to the archives, previous episodes, and any other resources related to this podcast, such as the Twitter account, the Facebook page, and the Google+ page, hopefully soon. Well, that's all the time we have for today, so tune in next week when I talk to another couple of geeks about something utterly and completely random. Take care, people.
Bye-bye.